Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Paul Skenazy, author of the new novel Temper CA from Miami University Press. Paul's essays, stories, and book reviews have appeared in a range of newspapers and magazines, and he's published critical work on noir writers such as Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and James M. Cain. He taught literature and writing at UC Santa Cruz for 35 years. His new book, Temper CA, won the 2018 Miami University Press Novella Prize. In the words of Jonathan Franzen, Paul Skenazy's fiction misbehaves, it swerves, it revisits ground and digs deeper, it confounds expectations. He has the gift of creating characters who are sympathetic, not in spite of their prickliness, but because of it, and of depicting human bonds that are all the tenser for being so strong. Paul Skenazy, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Thanks, Ken.
Paul, you wrote an essay, The World Left Behind, on your early days as a student at the University of Chicago.
Right.
And your introduction to the novels of Saul Bellow, who taught there.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that time and how you discovered Bellow's work through a very interesting way?
I come from a working class family in Chicago, and the University of Chicago was about as far from my parents' imagination as Timbuktu or any other cliche, but I was a good student, and I kind of followed a friend to the University of Chicago because he had a brother who had been there, and so I didn't know what I was doing, and I wound up there. And then as I got to my dorm, down the hall was this person whose name I didn't know, named Greg Bellow, and sitting on the wall, he had already put it up even though we were still just moving in, was something called the National Book Award, and there was a big plaque there. And I didn't know what a National Book Award was, and I didn't know what a Saul Bellow was. But it really, in some ways, changed my life, because for me, coming out of the Jewish working-class neighborhood that I had grown up in, I really didn't have any concept that I could be a writer, or that I could live my life thinking about books and teaching books and being entertained and excited by the life of the mind. And there was Bellow. And then it turned out that my dad actually had met him and knew him because they used to play baseball in the street together. And they grew up in the same kind of neighborhoods in Chicago.
There's one point in the essay where you asked your dad about him. He said that he remembered him, and he said, "Stuck-up kid, stunk at stickball."
Yeah, that's about. My dad was pretty straightforward about everything, and he was a very good ball player, good softball player, and so he, you know, whether you were good or bad, I mean, I never was quite good enough for him. So it was, yeah. So Bellow was. That was Saul Bellow to me. And then I actually picked up a copy of Henderson the Rain King that was remaindered in our university bookstore. And that was honestly the first book I read, though the big book for me was Herzog. It came out when I was a student in, I think, 1964. And it just, it talked to my dreams. It talked to my nightmares. It was sexy and exciting and at the same time depressing and full of a kind of pathetic, comic pathetic. I don't know how you say that, comic patheticism or something. And it really rocked me. And it was very important. I eventually met Bellow and had a brief interview with him, but it was years and years later.
That was actually probably my last question here.
Oh, sorry.
So maybe we'll get to that. No problem. But it's a great story. So I just wanted to connect it to the book towards the end. So
yeah,
into it then.
Anyway, he I only knew him by reputation at that point, and he taught a graduate course at Chicago. And I knew people who were taking it, but he was really a figure from the outside. And then years later, I was a book reviewer and interviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle. And it was when he was writing his very, very short novellas. And so I met him in a hotel lobby, and after exchanging notes about Greg, our mutual contact, we talked about his books. It was really interesting because I'm not generally an interviewer, but I started by saying something about the book, and then I talked something about the endings of his books, because at the endings of his books, there's a kind of a grace that comes over the characters that I've really never seen in another writer. And it's fluid and open, and it releases the characters from the kind of enclosures that a lot of the book is about. And so I mentioned that to him, and he said, the first thing he said was, "You finished reading the book," which was a shock.
A lot of interviewers don't.
So then he told me this wonderful story, which I'll just say, it was about, he said when he was a young man, he used to take the ferry across Lake Michigan, and the gulls would follow the ferry out to a certain point. And they would, you know, live in the wake of the boat. And then at a certain point, they really realized they had to turn back to shore. And he said he wanted to capture that sense of lightness and of freedom and of airiness in the gulls as they moved and they turned around in his prose at the ends of his books. And it was very moving to me because I really just, I hadn't heard anything like that from him before, but it fit. It just fit the way that he's, to me, the kind of voice that he was after.
And we'll return to that, Paul, because I wanted to kind of connect that to the ending of Temper CA.
Okay.
So,
but if you can do that, I'll be very complimented.
Now, in that same essay on Bello, you write, "If you lead a reader's life as I have, you discover that certain books and certain writers are as intimate as lovers or family. They shape the contours of your mind, give it boundary and dimension, direction and substance." Can you name a few books and writers that do that for you?
Well, we start with Bello, of course. Henry James has always done that for me. He's not the lightest reading in the world, but there's a kind of pleasure in the sentence that James provides that no one else does for me. Fitzgerald in The Great Gatsby and Tender as the Night. Particularly Faulkner, who I've always adored. My prose is exactly the opposite of Faulkner's, but it tries to be tight and lean, and Faulkner just exudes, almost sweats words out of himself. But those are probably the biggest people. Toni Morrison had a big influence on me when I was when I first discovered her. She was really a voice that seemed unlike any other. Maxine Hong Kingston, I edited a bunch of interviews with Maxine. And she, again, just kind of introduced me to worlds that I had no concept of. And then Grace Paley. In terms of the short story, I don't think there's anyone I love more than Grace's introductions of the whole neighborhood of New York City and the people, and particularly the women that she lived surrounded by, and the kind of pithy comedy that she brings into almost every sentence of hers.
Now, in addition to those writers, when you were a lit professor at UC Santa Cruz, you wrote several works of criticism.
Right.
And a lot of them were on prominent noir writers, so Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, James M. Cain.
Right.
Now, Temper CA takes place in a hot, sunny town, the fictional Temper, California, which is not the usual big city setting for noir novels.
Right.
There's no detective per se in the book, and you go easy on the colorful similes and streetwise characters that these writers love so much. But there are mysteries to solve in the book.
Yes.
I wonder, how did your studies of noir and detective stories influence this book?
Let me go back one chapter and say that my interest in noir came from my dad, and probably my interest in literature as a whole, because my dad used to read noir and had a thriller always stuck up in the sun visor of his car, because he would drive around the city a lot. And the other place that he kept them was hidden under his underwear and socks in his bottom drawer.
Why was that?
It was the year of the years of the 50s and 60s.
The lurid covers.
Yeah. And
the scantily clad
women.
Exactly. And guns.
So, exactly. And so I thought anything that he kept hidden and must be interesting. because I was that kind of guy, and I just, you know, if it was a secret, then I wanted to be in on the secret. And of course, that's really where I started, was kind of sneaking into his room when he was at work and reading these books, which were full of wonderfully lurid moments, which as a teenager, I just ate up. And I jokingly say this to students, but I'm sure that there's a kind of through the keyhole peeping Tom quality to my love of literature, and also to almost everyone's interest in literature, because you're getting these weird entrances into other people's lives. That's a very long answer to a short question.
Yeah, but it brings up my next question, which is also at UC Santa Cruz, you taught a course on memoir writing.
Yes.
And I was wondering the lessons you learned from your students and preparing for those courses and teaching them, did you incorporate any of those into the novel?
Probably less. Well, I mean, there's, I guess, two answers to that. One is the novel really emerged from one of those courses when a student of mine talked about growing up in Florida, as it happened, and at one point in her young life was able to pick up scorpions without getting stung. And it seemed to me an incredibly interesting image, because you wonder what happens to someone who can pick them up when they're young, and then eventually we all get stung by something or other. So I was really curious about the kind of bravery of this image. And that really led me to start thinking about the stuff that came into Temper. The other thing I would say is probably less the issues of memoir, but I also used to teach a course in oral history. And the large, you know, the real question in oral history is what is it like to walk in someone else's shoes? And you interview someone, but you want to capture their voice. And so really from the memoir courses and that course and some creative writing work that I did as a teacher, I kept asking students to try to figure out voices that were the opposite of their own, that were not like themselves. And I think that's kind of what led me to something like Joy Temper. I'm obviously not in my 30s anymore, and I'm not a lesbian, and I'm not a woman. But Joy's voice just started calling to me. And
how did that happen? I read that you had these images. One was the girl who could hold scorpions without getting stung, and another was of a woman with her legs draped over a chair smoking a cigarette in kind of a sulky way.
And it turned out to be Joy's mother. But I had this just vision of someone sitting cross-legged and crocheting, but with a real angry look in her eye. And somehow that led me to this crazy line, which I literally wrote down in one fell swoop, and which was, I wonder what my mother was like when she was in love. And so that was Joy talking about this woman who she had a photograph of, and my idea, which was her mother. Now, the photograph disappeared from the book, but the mother didn't, the anger didn't, and the relationship didn't. But the book itself morphed from really a focus on love to a focus, I think, more on forgiveness and questions of looking through the past and trying to understand it. And in that process, the characters, Joy essentially started talking to me. But part of what really compelled me was that I really was interested for a long, long time in the mother's story more than Joy's, because I'm in my 70s, I grew up, really, my political and social self came to life in the 60s and the early 70s. So I wanted to see what it was like for the children of my generation to look at us.
Because her parents, David and the mom, both raised her in kind of almost a hippie commune in Temper, CA, Temper, California.
I was never on a commune, but I know many people who were, and I have had the students of them in my classes. And so I really wanted to see who she would become out of the kind of transgressions and also ideals of that older generation. So that was really where the ambition for the book started. And it took me into a lot of weird curves and alleys before it came to what it came to.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to talk about that, because it's your first published work of fiction, and you write, it took me 15 years.
Right.
Submission to at least 50 contests and 20 agents, and to more than a dozen publishers to complete, revise, destroy, and recreate the book, to find the form, hone the language, and realize what the story was I wanted to tell. And there was another funny story here. I got, funny to me, maybe not to you at the time.
It's funny now.
Right. You write that you submitted the book to one agent that you were with for about a year.
Yes.
Who advised you to make the lead character, Joy Temper, more of an anti-heroine, because he said that the popular books at the time were Gone Girl and Girl on the Train. he advised you to make her a murderer, trying to pin the crime on someone else like her father.
Her
in the
father,
book.
Actually, yeah.
And you didn't, of course, and you got this response back from the agent, and this is what I found funny. But again, probably you didn't at the time. The agent wrote back to Paul, it's been a long time since a novelist without a fiction publishing track record took so little of my advice.
Yes.
What was that moment like when you got that
horrible
response?
What's horrible? I mean, it was horrible. I really was shocked because when I submitted the book, he read it literally over a weekend, called me the next day and said, I want to publish this book. I want to represent this book. I know a publisher. So when it didn't hit with the first two publishers that he sent it to, he really had this vision that we should reverse the ideals and idea of the book and turn it into this thriller with one of those girl voices and girl titles.
So what was commercially popular at
the time? Which was very popular at the time. And basically the premise of all those books is that you have an unreliable narrator who is dangerous. And so the whole premise is a female murderer or almost murderer or possible murderer or psycho, someone who's slightly schizophrenic. So I actually tried for most of the year to try to do that. And even after that comment that you just read, that was in the spring of that year. And I spent all of the summer trying to figure out again how to make that right. And then I submitted what I finally did, which was quite insane, I realized I could write this thriller because I really had this tradition of working with noir writers. So I wrote it. And then because that felt really pornographic to me as I was writing it, I wrote another version of it, which was more or less the book I wanted to write. And when I met him in New York, I turned both versions to him. And I sort of said, here's your version and here's my version. What do you think? And he didn't like the thriller version because I was still too psychological and I still was too interested in the background and the history. And he never read the other version. So at that point...
And you broke the relationship.
Yes, at that point I said, I think we're not doing each other any good. And he agreed and I moved on.
And what was the big break? That was the Miami University Novella Prize, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that took me another 8 months after that break. I took the novel back and again tried to rewrite it so it felt like mine again because I felt like it had been stolen in some way from me or I'd given it away, maybe it's better. And then a friend who was actually a former student who worked at Copperfield Books, which is a really fine bookstore chain in Northern California, was trying to connect herself with some agents. And she read the book, and she made some really practical suggestions about making a couple of scenes more vivid and stark. And so she tried to bring it to some agents, and they were vaguely interested. And then she said, you know, try putting a little more drama into a few of the scenes that you've got. And that's what I did. I mean, I finally went to a retreat in Oregon, and there I... avoided it for 2 weeks and then sat down and I don't know exactly what happened, but I just started redoing every scene. And literally at that point...
This just flowed out of you?
I did some research. It was Paisley, Oregon, and I did some research about oral histories there. And I walked around the cemetery because there's a cemetery that features prominently in the book. And suddenly this figure of a librarian came to me, which was one of the links that would allow me to do some historical and political commentary in the book without being overtly dogmatic and posturing. So at that point, it started. And within really quite literally a week, I produced a 65,000-word version of the book, which is about 250 pages. And then the Miami contest was coming up, and I had submitted a different earlier version of the book before. So I just sat myself down for another month and honed and cleaned and sharpened and tightened and got rid of some scenes that seemed superfluous. And I think in some interesting way, really finally taught myself how to write a novel because it meant cutting and asking yourself does this scene work? Does that scene work? What work is it doing? Where does it get you? What do you need to do next? And then I got lucky. I mean, really, I think
readers have gotten lucky too.
Well,
that Miami University took the chance.
But it just felt like the gods had graced me at that moment.
Now, most of the story takes place in the fictional town of Tempera, California. It's an old mining town
right. In
the process of being gentrified. I am guessing, since you mentioned Sonora in the book, this is probably about 130 miles due east of San Francisco. Why did you pick that setting? And you also mentioned integrating some of these oral histories from the high desert in Oregon,
like
the graveyard.
Yeah, I was interested in... if there's a California mythology, and I mean, there are many, of course, but the biggest one is the gold rush, because it's in some ways that notion which even the Chinese Americans looked towards when they called it the Gold Mountain, that there was a treasure underneath the surface of the earth that we could take and would make us whole, not only rich, but whole in some kind of psychologically pure way. And I think that's one of those draws that California has for people. And so if you're writing a California book, at some level, I think you have to contest that. I think you have to come to terms with that. And the gold country is just a perfect example. On a simple level, the gold country is a place where you see scorpions. It's part of the heat. And I wanted something that was fairly intense. I wanted something, essentially, there's no rain in this book. The parts in Tempera take place within a week, and I just wanted a scene that was really intense and in which the heat reflected the kind of difficulties and angers and frustrations and excitements and sexuality and passion that the characters were going through in that week. So I made up this town. I went online and looked at a bunch of towns. I mean, at some level, probably Columbia is as close an example of it, because Columbia really has become a gentrified version of the gold rush town. But it didn't have to be any specific place. And I just found some great stories in Oregon because of the settling there in the mid-19th and early 20th century. And they just led me to some myths that I took advantage of in terms of telling the history when I went back to the 19th century.
Now, you mentioned this before in terms of telling that history, and an important subplot of the book involves that librarian.
Right.
And the immigrant community, mostly Chinese,
yes,
in Tempera and the surrounding area. You give a little history on the discrimination they suffered and the oppression by the Anglos who came in and tried to profit off the gold rush. And that goes back to the founding...
Finally, parents.
Yeah, yes. Which was about 1848
right.
or something.
Yes.
And was that something you wanted to include at the start, or was that something that came along after those images of the girl and the scorpion and the very angry woman in the chair?
It came along later. it really was a study of generations at the first, not even a study. It was a story about generations, and I just wanted to dig into those people. But again, it's a hangover of the 60s that I can't imagine lives without thinking about the issues of money and power and authority and race. Those things don't go away in our culture. So I tried to figure out a way to put those in without preaching, and I couldn't.
No,
for
that's
a long time.
That's difficult to kind of put
yes,
that
and
in.
Yes, and I didn't want to be preachy, and it, you know, when I read paragraphs in which people spouted, I just threw them out.
But the librarian was the key.
The librarian was the key because she became a Chinese-American woman who'd been connected with Joy's family. I will say fairly early on, I did have the idea of the Temperas as the founding fathers and patriarchs of this town. And I didn't quite know what to do with it, but I had this image again of a general store and of them profiting off the gold mines and being essentially, store owners, but at the same time having this incredible investment in the life of the gold mines. And so the woman, Lucy, became a figure that suddenly just emerged, and I found a way to put her in, and she becomes the conduit between Joy and the past, as well as a part of the revelations that Joy
a big part of the mystery
comes
of the book.
To turn. And yes, exactly, and the mystery of the book. And so she led me into the darkness, but with a kind of light touch, I think. I'm hoping it was a light enough touch.
And the patriarch there who founded the town is Solomon.
Yes.
Temper, and he's very he's described in a very interesting way. Also, Joy talks to the skull of Solomon, or did
right.
when she was a kid.
Right.
And then receives the skull, I guess, as a gift from her dad.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
In the present day of the book, which is 2008.
Right. I had the image of the skull early on because I had this image of people finding skulls in the gold mines and again an image of the past, but I really didn't do much with it. I had the idea that Joy would talk to it and that her parents would overhear her, and this would be a way of their understanding what she cared about when she was a child. And then I followed that out with the idea of her being given a skull, but I wasn't sure that it actually was the same skull. So for a long time, I had two skulls in the book, and I didn't need two skulls. So that worked out. But that led me, actually, it was because of that image. Again, I work a lot in images. That led me to the whole question of ghosts and to think much more about ghosts and to connect the skull with the speaking to ghosts, to speaking to the past. And it connected Joy and her family to her Uncle Thomas, who is someone who is a kind of hobo figure and in some ways feels that he speaks to ghosts and has a way of being almost ghostly himself. And so in my mind, led me to connect the present, with Joy's fondness for her uncle, with the past, where the ghosts are really the ghosts that we don't want to recognize, that haunt us in a guilty way about things that we don't understand about our families.
And that was certainly something she wasn't aware of, or maybe wasn't even all that interested in until she came back. Well, of course, the major event that everything is pinned on is the funeral of her grandfather, Isaac,
right.
where she comes back from San Francisco, where she lives with her partner. And she attends the funeral and comes back to Temper, CA, and California, and finds out her dad has fixed up a house for her there. And
right.
so it's quite a connection that I guess she always knew she had, but it kind of hits her very strongly at that point.
Right.
And that's how the book
proceeds. She's kind of buried Temper in her life for almost 30 years. And this forces her, she thinks she's just going to come home and it's just going to be a week to help dad. But at some level, I think she even then knows that there's something buried, and she doesn't know what it is, and she's not really ready to face it, and she does her best to avoid it, like most of us. But at some point, it kind of hits her in the face.
I want to talk, without giving too much away, about the ending of the book, and I want to go back. I have the exact quote from your interview with Bello. You were saying, like before, you had some trouble. He was giving you just wrote by the book answers until you asked him about his endings. And he said, that's what I'm trying to get with the sentences, that quality of the bird's effortless flight. Those are the birds following the ferry that he's taking in Chicago. Their wings extended on the air currents from the boat that float and freedom. At that point, you said, when the air current ends and there's a return of the world left behind, that's what you were wondering. And he said, yes, that too. I found your ending kind of fits that
That's
strategy in a way.
Wow.
There's kind of an ambiguousness to the ending and yet kind of a denouement. There's a calming down. Again, I don't want to give too much away, but she finds some peace. Joy finds some peace at the end.
She does.
I want to know, I guess my question was how conscious of you, of Bello's answer at that time and what you wanted to do to end the book.
Completely unconscious. And I hadn't made the connection until you did, Ken, and I really appreciate it.
It's actually a Bello's ghost.
I think it's great. It's Bello's ghost, exactly. And I could very much call the ending of this book The World Left Behind and the circling back to it. And yes, in some ways she does learn how to fly in thinking about that in ways that she couldn't ever have imagined she could.
And there's a real grace I found to the ending, where a lot of the book
is
very concise, short sentences, short paragraphs, and of course a lot of mystery and intrigue and intensity throughout, and then the last few pages, that kind of drops down a bit.
Yes, and actually it worked. I had a very different ending, actually, in the version that won the novella prize. I had an afterword that took the characters into the future. And I think the judge rightly suggested maybe that was more than I needed. and we should leave things a little more
that,
open.
That is a smart judge, because I love the ending. Yeah.
Very smart judge. Yeah. And so it took me, I must have written another 8 versions of the ending and before I was satisfied that I had found it. And a lot of it depended on my discovering this this fact of the gold country, which is that at some points the trees become so intense and the insides of the trees explode, literally. And it seemed to me an apt metaphor for beginning to talk about some of the psychological things. I'm not giving anything away.
That happens towards the end of the book, but right. I was wondering if you made that up, but that's actually based on fact.
It's actually based on fact. Actually, it was something that my osteopath told me about, which I then explored. And I mean, I did a lot of research in backgrounds for it, but I'm not an expert on the gold country at all. But I've learned a lot by doing the book, and one of them is very much about that story.
Well, Paul, how can listeners find out more about your work, your upcoming events, your articles? I read quite a few of these online. There's at least 3 essays on your website, including the one about Bello.
Right. I do have a website, paulskenazy.com, and I always think I'm going to revise it, but it's there anyway. And it has a number of pieces that I've written. I've written a couple of recent things for a magazine, online magazine called Brevity, and they have a blog. And you can look up my name, and those articles will come to the surface.
And that's the one on the agent?
The one on the agent. And also there's actually a very thoughtful, I think thoughtful piece called 13 Thoughts on Writing, which gives some of the kind of things that I've learned over the last decade, trying to come to terms with what it is that we try to resist or we try to ignore about the kind of frustrations and mistakes and muddle that you get into in writing, and how you have to in some ways give into them much more than I was willing to when I first started. So if I have anything to tell anyone about writing, that's probably where they could find it. You can order my books through pretty much any bookstore. I hope Powell's carries it. I'm not sure. But they definitely can order it. It's obviously available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I think that's about all.
It's been a delight talking to you, Paul Skenazy. Thanks so much for coming into KBOO.
Thanks so much for yourself. Thanks, Ken. I really appreciate you having me.
We've been talking with Paul Skenazy, author of the new novel Temper CA from Miami University Press. You can learn more about Paul and his work at paulskenazy.com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Paul for visiting us at KBOO and to all of you for listening.